Conclusion. Slaying the Hydra. So Hercules called for help on Iolaus, his charioteer, who, by setting fire to a piece of the neighboring wood and burning the roots of the Hydra's heads with the brands, prevented them from sprouting. Having thus got the better of the sprouting heads, Hercules chopped off the immortal head and buried it, and put a heavy rock on it beside the road that leads through Lerna to Eleus. Pseudo-Apollodorus, The Library, Book 2, Chapter 5. On the surface, it seemed I had a fair amount in common with the man sitting across the table from me. We were around the same age, both Arabs by birth, both Muslims, both well-read in the scripture and literature of our faith. We had both been trained in counter-interrogation techniques, as his deft deflections of my questions made clear. Beyond that, our biographies diverged to such an extent that only in cosmological terms could we be said to live on the same planet. I was an FBI special agent, while Abu Jandal had once been the trusted bodyguard of Osama bin Laden. Needless to say, Jandal held rigid views on Islam, on America, and on the relationship between the two. He lectured me at length on each of these topics, and I let him talk. Then, a few days into our interview, I brought him a simple history, in Arabic, of the United States. Jandal was amazed. This self-described revolutionary had no inkling that America, the main enemy in bin Ladenist demonology, had itself been born in revolution. To him, it was simply some abstract place, like hell, perhaps. Along with Israel, the United States was, for Abu Jandal, the epicenter of all evil. It was about a week after 9/11. Jandal had heard about the attacks, but only in the most general terms. I brought in a magazine, pointed to the horrific pictures of people throwing themselves out of the burning Twin Towers. Bin Laden did this, I said. Jandal scoffed. The photos, he said, looked like something out of a Hollywood action movie. Even if they were real, he insisted, the attacks must be the work of the perfidious Israelis. The Sheikh is not that crazy, he said. But he no longer seemed convinced by his own words. In its final report on the events of September 11, 2001, the 9/11 Commission wrote, "The history, culture, and body of beliefs from which bin Laden shapes and spreads his message are largely unknown to many Americans. Seizing on symbols of Islam's past greatness, he promises to restore pride to people who consider themselves the victims of successive foreign masters. He uses cultural and religious allusions to the Holy Quran and some of its interpreters. He appeals to people disoriented by cyclonic changes as they confront modernity and globalization. His rhetoric selectively draws from multiple sources, Islam, history, and the region's political and economic malaise. Thus our strategy must match our means to two ends, dismantling the Al-Qaeda network and, in the long term, prevailing over the ideology that contributes to Islamist terrorism." Since 9/11, and particularly since the Arab Spring, the threat has evolved. This book has chronicled that evolution and highlighted some of the important personalities who represent change or, conversely, continuity in the Al-Qaeda movement. From this history, I draw several conclusions. First, Al-Qaeda and its progeny are remarkably resilient. In 1989, bin Laden left Afghanistan in disgrace when his rash miscalculation at the Battle of Jalalabad led to the deaths of thousands of Arab fighters. 7 years later, he was ejected from Sudan under international pressure. In 2001, after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, bin Laden and Zawahiri went on the run, while Saif al-Adl and other senior figures languished in an Iranian prison. Each time, Al-Qaeda has seemed doomed to fail, but has actually recovered and come back stronger. Instead of imploding after 9/11, it mutated to fit the new reality, becoming a series of franchises across North and East Africa and the Arab world, governed by an umbrella organization based in northern Pakistan. This new model has not only survived its founder's death, it has expanded its membership exponentially. As expected, Ayman al-Zawahiri, struggling under his reputation as an interloper, has not proved a charismatic leader. Most notably, he was unable to keep the Islamic State in the fold, although it is by no means clear that bin Laden would have done any better in this regard. On the other hand, under Zawahiri's leadership, the remaining franchises have regenerated their capacity to carry out deadly terrorist attacks. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula has held and governed territory in Yemen. Meanwhile, Al-Qaeda's overall membership has grown exponentially, and the organization has successfully faced down challenges from the Islamic State and its international provinces. The Islamic State offers a parallel object lesson in the durability of terrorist groups. It seemed on the brink of collapse in 2007 and 2008, its senior leadership either dead, in hiding, or in prison. But the group's supply of capable leaders, many of them former Saddam operatives, coupled with the Iraqi government's mishandling of Sunni unrest and the power of the Islamic State's message to attract fresh recruits, ensured its survival. It rose to even greater prominence in 2014 when it set itself up as the government of large areas of northern Iraq and northeastern Syria. By the middle of 2016, the Islamic State was once again in decline. But the growing strength of its provinces, particularly in Libya, suggests that, like Al-Qaeda before it, the Islamic State may be poised to evolve into a multinational umbrella group with a number of franchises. That evolution, together with the impending elevation of Hamza bin Laden to a place of power within Al-Qaeda, may yet open the door for a reunification between Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. Second, sectarianism has become a central feature of conflicts in the Middle East, and this will remain the case for the foreseeable future. Between 2003 and 2006, the Jordanian terrorist Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, acting under the Al-Qaeda banner but against the orders of his nominal superiors, turned Al-Qaeda in Iraq into a machine for murdering Shia Muslims as well as fighting the United States, and thereby bequeathed Iraq a sectarian bloodbath that continues to this day. Zarqawi did not invent the concept of sectarianism, which has figured in Middle East power struggles since the Ayatollahs took power in Iran in 1979. But its importance has grown with Iraq's transition to a Shia-led government, the Iranian-Saudi proxy wars in Syria and Yemen, and of course, the rebirth of Zarqawi's movement as today's Islamic State. Sectarian hatred was never an explicit part of bin Laden's agenda. His mother, after all, is an Alawite, a member of the same Shia sect as Bashar al-Assad. But violence against Shia Muslims and their cultural symbols has proved a potent recruiting tool for the Islamic State, as well as its Iranian-backed opponents. We should not expect governments or non-state groups in the region to abandon sectarianism anytime soon. Third, the Arab Spring has shifted Al-Qaeda's calculus. In the months before bin Laden's death, the uprisings dissolved his monomaniacal focus on defeating the United States. To bin Laden, the wave of state failure sweeping the region in the first half of 2011 appeared to represent the chaos predicted in the management of savagery. If that was true, bin Laden reasoned, it was time to move to the next stage, building trust among local populations. Thus, holding territory and providing government services are now as much a part of the agenda of Al-Qaeda franchises as are acts of terrorism against apostate Arab governments. And on both aspects of this agenda, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is in the lead. Unlike the Islamic State, however, Al-Qaeda still does not believe the time has come to proclaim a restored caliphate. Hence the disagreement, often bloody, over whether IS constitutes a state in the true sense of the word. Fourth, the war in Syria has exposed the true nature of the struggle underlying the rise of Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. The conflict is a rebuke to the worldview put forward in books like Samuel Huntington's 1996 The Clash of Civilizations, which envisage an epic conflict between cultures, Western, Islamic, Orthodox, and so on, to replace the Cold War's confrontation between democratic and communist economic and political systems. After 9/11, some commentators seized upon this theory to explain what was going on, but one glance at the complicated lattice of strife enmeshing the contemporary Middle East is enough to suggest that, if anything, the world has reverted to the norm of intra-civilizational conflict. Sunnis fight Shia, Persians battle Arabs, Turks struggle with Kurds, and on down to the tribal, communal, and even neighborhood level. All of the major combatants are Muslim. For all their military might, outside powers like the United States and the Russian Federation can at best only marginally affect the outcome. As we struggle to make sense of the multiplicity of state and non-state actors vying for control in the modern Middle East, we must be able to answer a question the 9/11 Commission asked itself over a decade ago. Who is the enemy? The Commission began its answer in this way. The enemy is not just terrorism. It is the threat posed specifically by Islamist terrorism. The enemy goes beyond Al-Qaeda to include the radical ideological movement, inspired in part by Al-Qaeda, that has spawned other terrorist groups in violence. Together, we need a subtler approach, one informed by a deep understanding of jihadi ideology and the personalities who attempt to carry it out. The term Islamist terrorism is not nuanced enough for the times we live in. Indeed, the Islamist movement has always been a fragmented one. If we look to the Al-Qaeda literature, we find a five-part typology of Sunni Islamist organizations. First, Al-Qaeda's own creed, the global Salafi jihadi movement. Second, the Sahwa, Salafism popular in Saudi Arabia, which also seeks to implement a Salafi understanding of Sharia, but gradually and through peaceful means. Third, the Muslim Brotherhood, the international group of which Egypt's former president, Mohamed Morsi, is a leading member. Fourth, the political Islam of the late Hassan al-Turabi, according to which Sudan has been governed since 1989. And finally, the popular jihad practiced by groups like Hamas, which piggybacks onto pre-existing secular political struggles like the one between Israel and the Palestinians. For Al-Qaeda, all these substrains are susceptible to secularism, heresy, and political compromise, with one exception: the Salafi jihadi movement, of which Al-Qaeda forms a prominent part. Today, with the split between Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, we are witnessing a clash within the Salafi jihadi strain itself, a division not about the end goal, both sides believe in a restored caliphate, but how quickly to get there. This, then, is the enemy with which this book has been concerned. Not Islam, not radical Islam, not even jihadism, but Salafi jihadism, especially in its two major contemporary manifestations, Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. In seeking solutions to this problem, the United States has tended to turn to its intelligence and law enforcement apparatus, and even more readily, to its armed forces. It is easy to see why. The American military is one of the most formidable war-winning machines in history. We should not be afraid to use it to stop terrorists from exploiting the vacuums created by state failure. In such circumstances, covert intelligence gathering, special forces raids, drone strikes, and training of local security services are all vital tools. But being in possession of the world's best hammer, as President Obama memorably put it in an address to the cadets at West Point, we must be careful not to see every problem as a nail. Instead, when confronted with the kind of societal collapse that fosters terrorism, we must be crystal clear on exactly what the job of the military is: to hold back the bad guys and, by so doing, provide time and space in which to build the institutions necessary for lasting peace. To actually craft such institutions, You need to use all the tools of diplomatic, political, and economic support at your disposal. Right now, unfortunately, our plans never seem to look beyond the military phase. And so, in places like Afghanistan and Iraq, we have gotten ourselves into a vicious cycle. Invade, occupy, withdraw, repeat. Imagine if, in Europe after World War II, there had been no Marshall Plan. And after defeating Hitler and Mussolini, the United States had simply occupied the continent. Europeans would rightly have seen America not as an ally, but as a hostile power, and history would have been very different. Fortunately, the United States did not behave in that way. Instead, through the Marshall Plan, we worked hard to rebuild the shattered societies, economies, institutions, and infrastructure left behind by 6 years of war. We should bear that in mind today when we encounter societies afflicted by the cancer of jihadism. Under our current approach, it seems that no matter how many times we defeat al-Qaeda on the field of battle, it keeps coming back to life stronger than before. Hercules faced a similar test when he fought the Lernaean Hydra. After a few rounds of lopping off heads, he realized that the sword alone would not get the job done, so he called for help. Not from another mythological hero like himself, but from his humble charioteer, who wielded a brand to cauterize the neck and prevent another head from sprouting. Al-Qaeda's neck, the attribute that more than any other allows it to keep growing new heads ad infinitum, is its narrative, the message it uses to attract new recruits from all over the world. When I heard the news of bin Laden's death, I was determined that the United States should not assume that al-Qaeda was finished. I wrote, "Investigations, intelligence, and military successes are only half the battle. The other half is in the arena of ideas and countering the rhetoric and methods that extremists use to recruit. We can keep killing and arresting terrorists, but if new ones are recruited, our war will never end." For more than two generations, al-Qaeda has successfully peddled the view that the West is engaged in a war against Islam, with the active connivance of client rulers in capitals around the Muslim world. This opinion is by no means confined to a handful of extremists. On the contrary, millions of Muslims around the world believe that the West is deliberately suppressing their religion and stifling political change in order to keep repressive secular governments in power. Unfortunately, almost nothing is being done to counter this impression, giving jihadis free rein to exploit the misconception for their own ends. Indeed, the United States has fueled the narrative by invading Iraq, apparently fulfilling Salafi jihadi prophecies that tell of an apocalyptic battle for Mesopotamia. By imprisoning hundreds without charge at Guantanamo Bay, by mocking Islamic taboos in order to humiliate prisoners at Abu Ghraib, by failing to avoid civilian casualties from airstrikes, by doing little to end repressive sectarianism in Syria and Iraq, and in myriad other ways. The West's inability or unwillingness to defeat the Islamic State provides further grist for our enemy's propaganda mill. In theory, the United States stands at the head of a coalition of over 60 nations ranged against the Islamic State. In practice, most of these make no contribution, or only a token contribution to the fight. But of course, that does not stop the Islamic State from claiming that it has stood up to America and its dozens of global allies, something IS propagandists are able to hold up as evidence that they are invincible, that God is on their side, that the apocalypse is on the way, and on and on. Groups like the Islamic State and al-Qaeda imprison potential recruits in ideological echo chambers in which every new piece of information is interpreted as evidence supporting jihadi messages. If IS suffers a defeat, it must be because of Shia treachery. If it wins a victory, that is evidence of God's favor. It becomes almost impossible for the truth to reach these recruits. Thus, despite the repulsiveness of their politics and the weakness of their theology, the extremists' false promise of history-making adventure comes through loud and clear, while competing messages are barely heard at all. Fundamentally, People need to feel that they are in control of their destinies, that they are part of a broader whole, and that their lives matter. What is on offer in the depressed cities and neighborhoods from which the Islamic State draws most of its recruits, be they in the Muslim world or the West, is just the opposite: a life of mediocrity, isolation, and tedium. So it is no surprise that in its propaganda videos, the Islamic State goes out of its way to depict its recruits as enjoying action, excitement, and comradeship. How can we begin to counter such messages? How do we cauterize the wounds from which extremism grows? First, we must expose the basic hypocrisy of a movement that claims to be the arbiter of true Islamic piety, yet routinely bombs mosques, including, in 2016, the second holiest in the world, the Prophet's Mosque in Medina, a site visited by millions of Muslim pilgrims every year, particularly during the month of Ramadan, when the Islamic State chose to strike. While we are laying bare the lies, we must craft a true story to drown out the false ones terrorists tell. It is not a question of trying to match jihadi claims tit for tat with bare denials, but of creating an entirely new narrative, ideally one with even greater appeal, because it is based not on lies and despair, but on truth and hope. Such a story has the potential to push thousands of young off the treadmill of radicalization before it carries them into the jihadi echo chamber. But the narrative will only succeed if it is tailored, like that of the terrorists, not just from country to country, but down to the level of different groups and communities. The reasons people join groups like Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State vary radically from country to country. In some African nations, for example, economic reasons factor highly, alongside ethnic and familial motives. Security officials in Singapore found users of extremist websites especially drawn to the idea of taking up arms to protect fellow Muslims. Elsewhere, the touchstone might be sectarianism, ethnic chauvinism, or tribal rivalries. Counter-strategies need to be similarly focused. Boilerplate messages about how killing is un-Islamic or the West is not at war with Islam are too vague and too easily dismissed. The identity of the messenger is equally critical. People are likely to dismiss messages they see as coming from the West or from a distrusted local government, and often with good reason. Where terrorists recruit using religious ideology, scholars and clerics are the ones best placed to deliver a counter-narrative. Scholars from Singapore's religious rehabilitation group play a critical role in countering extremist narratives by, among other things, emphasizing the importance of moderation in Islamic practice. Similarly, when extremists target would-be recruits through local or tribal grievances, community leaders should head up the response. Rehabilitated former terrorists, where they exist, have the credibility to debunk the idea that terrorism is an honorable and exciting lifestyle, as they have done to great effect as part of the UK's strategy in Northern Ireland. While each group and situation is unique, counter-narrative approaches that have worked elsewhere can be adapted and tailored to new challenges. Germany is working to rehabilitate and reintegrate returnees from Syria using techniques devised to deal with repentant neo-Nazis. The Netherlands initially developed its program to respond to the jihadi extremist Hofstad network, but Dutch authorities have successfully applied a similar approach to countering other extremists, including right-wing Islamophobes. These particular programs may or may not achieve results right away, but at the very least, they represent a step in the right direction. If you want to inoculate a population permanently against the disease of extremist ideology, you need to give them the tools of critical thinking to resist false narratives and identify true ones. As we saw earlier, a striking dearth of educational opportunity and the resultant paucity of critical thinking skills makes many Arab countries fertile ground for extremist groups whose leaders spout dogma and demand almost blind obedience to orders. In the absence of the healthy skepticism we in the West take for granted, recruiters are able to distort religion and twist the truth into a set of outlandish conspiracy theories. Thus, institutions of learning form a frequent jihadi target. The nickname of the Nigerian terrorist group, Boko Haram, literally means Western education is forbidden. And indeed, that describes a key pillar of its cause. But Boko Haram is hardly unique on this front. Both Al-Shabaab and the Taliban have been known to target universities. In October 2012, 9 months before Boko Haram killed more than 40 people, mostly students, during an attack on a school in Yobe State, the Pakistani Taliban tried to murder 15-year-old Malala Yousafzai, a prominent campaigner for education for girls like herself, by shooting her in the head. Why? Because the Taliban knows that the biggest long-term threat to its existence is neither planes nor tanks, but teachers and books. In the end, it is education and critical thinking that will truly blow the doors off the Taliban's backward ideology. If we want to tackle bin Ladenism, therefore, we could do worse than to bankroll the building of schools and the training of teachers. Those who commit themselves to jihad rarely turn from that path voluntarily. But we must leave the door open for those who do, not least because of their value in terms of delivering a convincing counter-narrative. Those who repent must be appropriately punished for their actions, of course, but whenever possible, they should also have a chance at rehabilitation. Over the last decade, Singapore, Indonesia, Saudi Arabia, and Malaysia have realized some measure of success in operating official rehabilitation programs that take a long view of what is, after all, a long-standing challenge. These initiatives are not free of problems, of course, but what each of these countries has ultimately understood is that successful rehabilitation efforts take time. We in the West, with our proclivity for quick political fixes, stand to learn a lot. Rehabilitation programs must be made to work before it is too late. Someday, probably sooner rather than later, the fighting in Syria will end, and when that happens, some 12,000 foreign fighters, their combat skills honed in the ranks of the Islamic State, al-Nusra, Ahrar al-Sham, and any number of other militant groups, will begin pouring out of the Levant. Some will simply move on to whatever they regard as the next Syria, be it Libya, Yemen, or elsewhere. But many will return home, some of them planning to bring the fight with them, others brutalized and traumatized by the death and maiming and disease and anarchy they have witnessed. War has always taken a psychological toll on its combatants, but to treat a person as a hardened terrorist solely because he fought in Syria is to further dehumanize him. Such an approach can only reinforce the bin Ladenist creed that Muslims everywhere are under violent attack and have a duty to respond in kind. By contrast, helping them to readjust, working to rehabilitate them, equipping them with alternative narratives and with the critical thinking skills necessary to spot a false story is not only the right thing to do, it is also the prudent thing to do. The more the United States can be involved in that effort, the more it will be seen as the guarantor of peace in the Middle East and around the world, instead of what it has so long been, the bringer of practically perpetual conflict. What is decidedly not needed is the sort of bureaucratic entanglement that too often stands out as a Washington hallmark. The United States has been working on developing a countering violent extremism program, but it has needlessly spread the domestic portfolio across a range of agencies, from the Department of Education to the FBI, muddling strategy and hog-tying operations. The resulting inertia is a tragic waste. This form of leverage is far too valuable to wither on some administrative vine. The fact is, these programs have been proven to work, even in some of the toughest and most hate-filled places on earth. The first year of a new presidency can be fertile ground for reshaping policy. I hope that the Trump administration will take to heart the lessons we have learned, at great cost in both blood and treasure, about the necessity of countering terrorist ideology. All too often, the debate about jihadism becomes clouded by the fact that jihadists have co-opted the language of Islam to justify their crimes. I hope that in the course of this book, I have shown that there is nothing Islamic about terrorism. To underline the point, let me close with a personal example from a Western, English-speaking society that is overcoming decades of terrorism and sectarian strife, Northern Ireland. Several years ago, I arrived in Belfast just ahead of the annual Protestant Orange Walk, a controversial sectarian parade that sometimes passes through or near predominantly Catholic neighborhoods. I was being driven down what turned out to be part of the parade route in a Protestant part of town when I saw a huge pile of wood stacked in an open area, protected by security guards. "What's up?" I asked my driver.
"Oh," he said, "that's the bonfire."
"And the guards?"
"They're making sure no one from the other side sneaks in and lights it beforehand."
"So, they have the walk?"
"Yes," he cut in. "They march, then they light the fire, then they burn the effigy of the Pope."
"The Pope?" I asked in amazement. This was back during Benedict XVI's reign. "The Pope is German."
"Ah," my driver answered without missing a beat, "but he's Catholic, isn't he?"
A few days later, still in Belfast, I met with a Catholic whom I will call John. He told me that he had grown up wanting to be a British soldier. Then the troubles started. He watched his home torched. He heard his mother being called a Catholic whore by the soldiers manning checkpoints dotted all over his small part of the world. Instead of a British soldier, he became an IRA fighter, and a ruthless one at that. John had done more than his share of killing and of prison time. In 1981, he took part in the infamous hunger strike in protest against the treatment of IRA prisoners as ordinary criminals rather than combatants. Decades later, John still couched his story in sectarian terms. Protestant this, Catholic that. I'd heard similar things many times, not only in my counterterrorism work, but growing up in the Middle East. Sunni this, people would say, Shia that. Christian this, Alawite that. Druze this, Jew that. Finally, out of the blue, I asked John a simple question. "Do you believe in God?" The question caught him off guard. He chewed on it for a while before answering. "I don't want to insult you or anyone else in this room," he said finally. "But you know, God is a stupid idea." If he were being honest, would Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the architect of 9/11, have said the same thing? KSM purported to be a faithful Muslim, but his trips to Filipino brothels are well documented. Mohammed Atta pounded shots of vodka before boarding American Airlines Flight 11 on September 11, 2001. In the preceding weeks, his fellow hijackers had been spotted enjoying the services of lap dancers. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the founder of what became al-Qaeda in Iraq and eventually the Islamic State, was a drug-dealing thug who graduated to ordering suicide bombers to attack weddings and mosques. Perhaps Zarqawi, KSM, and the 9/11 hijackers would not go so far as to say that God is a stupid idea. But in their lives, they certainly showed little enough respect for what they professed to regard as the Almighty's commandments. So what exactly motivates people like John and KSM, if not religious fervor? We know some of the answers. Nationalism, tribalism, sectarianism, old wounds that never seem to heal. You cannot pray or kill your way out of a bind like that. But you can try to find a new path and forge a new understanding. Since the mid-1990s, Northern Ireland has taken great strides down that path. With the right strategy and a bit of luck, the Muslim world can too. Those who kill on behalf of al-Qaeda and other violent Salafi jihadi groups are brutal men who have caused bloodshed and chaos and suffering almost beyond belief. Some of them, like Ayman al-Zawahiri and Saif al-Adl, possess a demonic intelligence. But they are not geniuses. Believe me, I have interrogated enough of them to know. Among them, you will not find an Einstein or a Kissinger. Put four in one room, and they will state 50 different opinions, pronounce 20 fatwas,
and wind up hating one another. If you know who they are and how they are connected, and if you understand the forces that drive them, you can begin to anticipate their next move and, in the long run, start to undermine their appeal. If nothing else, I hope this book has contributed in some small measure to that process of understanding.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Anatomy of Terror, written by Ali Soufan, performed by Aaron Abano. Executive producers, Kristen Lang and Mike Charzik. Producer, Neil Basic. Copyright 2017 by Ali Soufan. Production copyright 2017 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.